When Jesus had crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue rulers named Jairus came there. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. As a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, she had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all that she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I will be healed." Immediately, her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once Jesus realized that the power had gone out of him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding against you," the disciples said, "and yet you can ask, 'Who touched me?'" But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing that what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet. And trembling with fear, she told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." While Jesus was still speaking, some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Ignoring what they had said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, "Don't be afraid, just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion, with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood and walked around. She was about 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. This is the Gospel of Christ.
Praise to Christ the Lord. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our Rock and our Redeemer. Amen. So at this point in the story of David, he has been fleeing from Saul and some of his attacks for quite some time. And now finally, the one who is seeking for his life is dead. Actually, something like that reminded me of some of the car chase scenes sometimes seen in movies. I think you remember them. You've probably seen them in James Bond movies, but Liam Neeson has probably in recent years has been more the person who's been involved for some. I want to take you through one of those examples. Because when his character is able to flee with his daughter from criminals who want to take revenge on him, they together manage to get hold of a taxi and steal that. They want to get into the safety of the embassy with that, they're in the Middle East there. And so Liam Neeson's character tells his daughter to drive and drive fast, while he himself uses the gun to keep the pursuers away. It also seems that the criminals have also contacts in the police, and so soon the single car is chased by police and criminals alike. The pursuit goes through narrow streets at breakneck speeds, with people lunging out of the way as the cars pass through them. Crates of vegetables fly in all directions, followed by other goods of street sellers. Property gets ripped apart. Cars that try to get out of the way smash into walls. Police cars crash into each other, taking not only the cars, but also the policemen out of action. The shooting between criminals in a black Mercedes and Liam Neeson's character gets quite intense in those crowded streets. And it seems one of Neeson's shots takes out the driver, and the car veers off the road to catapult into the air, and it lands violently and is a smashed wreck at the end. Well, they have shaken off all their pursuers but one car. Driving across a railway yard, Neeson's character urges his daughter to race a freight train. They cross the train's path and just make it, but the car pursuing them does not. The smash, of course, is horrific. The car exploding in a ball of fire, and there's a sigh of relief at the end. The protagonists have made it safely, having shaken off all who want to harm them. And after the excitement, we feel relieved, we as those viewers of the movie, because we identify with the protagonists. And my wife tells me that I have to enjoy it, but I can't help but wonder how many bystanders were hurt, if not killed. How many mothers will cry in despair because the money they invested in the goods and the vegetables to sell on the market is all gone? What about the policemen? They just followed orders to stop a speeding car, didn't they? Are they just expendable? What about the criminals themselves? Were many of them not pressured into this life at a young age? And so is the pursuit of this man not the result of an unbroken cycle of vengeance in which their deaths, the deaths of the criminals, are just another sacrifice? We know that people die on the wayside as the few make it to safety and success. We see that again and again in the movies, but we see it also in some of the great legends and literary works, not least because it actually reflects history. How many kings, how many emperors, how many liberators, how many revolutionaries have made their way to success on a path of corpses? How many peasants, citizens, and foot soldiers have been collateral damage in the pursuit of glory, or in the quest of national security, or the more laudable aim of freedom? How many livelihoods and reputations have been destroyed by political victories? How many lives have been broken and embittered in our competitive market economy when competition is the end-all and be-all of our value system? How many people even have scars from power struggles between and within churches? Do we care about those who fall by the wayside, or do we have a winner-takes-all mentality? Conflicts normally do have losers. When we win, others lose. And so when we can no longer grieve at the suffering of our enemies, then we have lost sight of our common humanity. David did not rejoice when he heard about the deaths of Saul and Jonathan. At this point, his path to kingship was finally opened, but David laments and sees the enormity of the situation, how the mighty have fallen. That David would mourn over the death of his friend Jonathan is understandable, even though in the context of the rivalry between the house of Saul and the house of Jesse, it is still remarkable. But that David should mourn so deeply the death of Saul, who tried to kill him, who, as the book of Samuel says, was rejected by God, that David should mourn Saul so deeply, that should make us pause. David's ascent to the throne is an unstopping movement in the books of Samuel, but it is not a singular sweep of the hero against evil forces. The story is much more subtle. There's Jonathan, who is portrayed as the most capable man in the house of Saul to be king. And yet, Jonathan surrenders that expectation to be king to what he perceives to be the will of God. And there's Saul, who was first anointed to be king of Israel, but then relied on his own strength and fell from grace. Nevertheless, David's respect for Saul as king continues, and David sees the human side in the intense rivalry. The beautiful poem we heard today is still learned by school children in Israel because it's one of the classic Hebrew passages. It is David's lament, and it brings an important message to the story. It is that in the large sweep of history, in the struggles of this world, in the battles we fight, real humans are affected. Suffering and grief temper all the apparent victories. We are all wounded. Weep, therefore, weep for the mighty that God has brought down from their thrones while he has lifted up the lowly. Weep for those who have fallen by the wayside of history. Weep when you think that your side has won. Weep when a wicked person dies, for God does not take pleasure in the death of the wicked. Weep when a good person dies, even though that death may be for the profit of many. Weep also when a young girl dies, for death is even more painful when we see all the potential, all the hope, all the loveliness of life drain away from someone that is in the midst of life. And so the story of Jairus' daughter touches us deeply. Lament for that little girl is unrestrained. After all, there are few comforts. We cannot point back to a life well lived, or even to the release from suffering after long illness. Nor do we hear that suppressed voice that a death was somehow for the better. No, in this case, the grief is unrestrained and death is shown at its ugliest. And through it, we are again reminded of the finality of death that threatens all our lives. And Jesus? Well, Jesus did not weep. There's no scene that would compare with Jesus' sadness at Lazarus' tomb. No, he tells the neighbors and family not to weep, because the girl is not dead, but just sleeping. I think we should take Jesus at his word here and really see this as a healing at the point of death rather than a resurrection from the dead. So why does Jesus tell the people not to weep? Because he asked them not to despair, but to have faith. There are times at which we have to weep at the suffering, even among other feelings such as relief or gratitude. But there are also times when weeping, when grieving, when a focus on our suffering obscures our view of hope and hinders us from seeing God's power at work in the world. In Jesus, God breaks into this world of suffering and death and brings hope. Hope that does not just hold back death, as Jesus did in this case, and as we may currently do through the advances of medicine, but rather hope that is founded on the victory over death and evil. And yet, I know it's sometimes difficult to see that hope through our tears. The woman suffering from bleeding for 12 years had hope, but through that she had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors, as the text puts it. After all that disappointment, would it not have been better to acknowledge the suffering and live with it? In Jesus, however, she received new hope and faith that through Jesus, God would not only address the suffering of the world, but also her own individual suffering, and she was healed. Now, I don't think that the gospel is somehow a religiously cloaked exhortation for the power of perseverance to always look at the good things in life, which we often find in our media today. We often read about people fighting cancer and other difficult circumstances. Often they are praised for their courage and bravery. That may indeed be good. But often there's also the message that if only you would be as mentally tough and courageous as them, you could also overcome the odds and beat those difficulties. I don't think that is the same as faith. For faith is not focused on ourselves, drawing the inner strength out of ourselves. In the Gospels, faith is instrumental in all Jesus' healings, but it is not faith in the person's inner strength, but rather faith in God. Those who were healed had faith that God redeems this world, that God also addresses the individual situation, and that in Jesus, God is decisively present and active here and now. I think the combination of these readings reminds us of the suffering and death in this broken world, which are pervasive even where God's presence is manifest, sometimes especially there. We are called to recognize the suffering, are called to weep with those who suffer, even though they may have made a mess of their own life. And then we can see our own suffering and our own problems in context. Only when we see the brokenness and hurt in this world do we fully understand the hope and healing that are given through Jesus. And then we are called to live by that hope. Amen.